is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 41. We got a great show for you today. We're talking a little bit more about growing hops. I have just one announcement, which, of course, Beersmith 2.1 is out, and the new Beersmith recipe site at beersmithrecipes.com. I recommend you visit both of those. Go to beersmith.com to download the new version of the software, or beersmithrecipes.com to access, I think there's several thousand recipes out there now for you to search, and got a nice search engine built into that site. Just type in a couple words, and you'll be at your favorite recipes. And now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Jason Peralt from Peralt Farms, which is a family-run business in the Yakima Valley. They were established in 1902, over 110 years ago. Jason's a fourth-generation hop grower. They specialize in both conventional and organically grown craft beer hops, including Simcoe, Summit, Anthem, Cascade, Palisade, Citra, and many others. Jason's also a hop breeder from Select Botanicals Group, a member of Hop Breeding Company, LLC. And today we're going to talk a little bit about hop varieties and also how our hops are grown and processed. Jason, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
But Jason, can you tell us a little bit about your family business out there in Yakima Valley?
A vertically integrated hop operation. The farm, like you said, is we're fourth generation hop farmers here in Yakima, and we grow several hundred acres of both conventional and organic hops. As you mentioned, we specialize in several different hop varieties, and primarily we're focusing in on ones that we've developed ourselves, such as Simcoe, Autanum, Palisade, Citra, Mosaic, and others that have come out of either Select Botanicals Group or Hop Breeding Company. Right now, the farm is probably about 90% hops, but we also have some cherries and some pears to kind of round that out. And I guess that's about it. That's kind of the quick answer to that.
What makes growing hops in the Pacific Northwest and especially the Yakima Valley so special? What's different about that particular area?
Well, you could actually get really technical with that. And the main reason that hops do as well as they do in this area is the day length. You'll find that most hop producing regions, most major hop producing regions, are centered right around the 45th to 48th parallel, right around in there. And that's simply because they have the proper mix of day length at the long days at the right time to induce proper growth, and then followed by a shortening of the days, which induces flowering right at the right time so we can maximize crop. But other than that, that kind of makes the Pacific Northwest itself optimal for growth. But the Yakima Valley in particular is optimal due to our arid, dry conditions. We're less prone to diseases such as powdery mildew and downy mildew than maybe some of the more humid regions where hops were traditionally grown, some of the more maritime climates.
You still get a fair amount of rain, though, right?
Not in the Yakima Valley. No, we're considered high desert here, and so in the Yakima Valley we only get 7 to 10 inches of precipitation a year, and it usually averages on the lower side of that, so closer to the 7-8 inches. That differs from areas such as the Willamette Valley in Oregon, which does get quite a bit more rainfall than we do. What we've been able to do is we compensate with irrigation. So we're able to irrigate and give the plant the water it needs.
Because hops need a fair amount of water, don't they?
They do. They take up a lot of water, and we apply that primarily through drip irrigation, so we get as efficient water usage as possible.
Now, you also grow organic hops. What's different about organic hops? I mean, a bit of a specialty market, but
Certainly are a specialty market, and but it presents several more challenges than we have with the conventional. Obviously, your pest control toolbox is much more limited, and the tools that are there available to you. And by tools, I'm talking sprays and other chemicals that you can use. They're not nearly as effective. you know, they're just a single piece in the whole process. So we really need to take a much more integrated approach with regard to pest control and nutrient management, because you don't have those effective tools that you would have available to you on the conventional side. So it's not too much different than any other organic crop. It's just for example, mites and aphids in hops can be a very fast reproducing pest that if they get a foothold, they can be hard to control even on the conventional side if they're allowed to get too high in population. With the organics, it's just that much more critical because we don't have those tools. So you got to stay on top of things that much more.
So how do you control those pests? I mean, what are the...
Well, it's a combination of things. Ironically, with organic hops, we actually spray those more than we do conventional hops. So our sprayer is actually out there probably on at least a weekly basis, so on a 7-day rotation. But we're spraying a different kind of chemical. It's a softer chemical. Usually, it's plant oil derived.
So natural
oils derived from plants that we use. Yeah, more of a natural-based product that are, you know, approved for organic usage. But then we also rely on the natural predator population. The whole idea is to spray chemicals that are soft, that will slow down the reproduction of your pests, your target pests, that are soft on your beneficial insects. And so we're constantly monitoring on a weekly basis not only our pest levels, but what we call our predator levels as well. So we have several predatory mites. There's lacewings, mm-hmm. ladybugs, stethorus beetles. There's several different predators out there that we monitor. And hopefully, by using the right mix of sprays, we can bring their populations up. And as the pest levels rise, so does the predator levels. And they kind of keep a balance there, keep in check. Doesn't always work that way. You have to consider that the pests have a bit of an advantage from the standpoint that a hop field is a naturally, genetically, it's just a single genotype throughout the whole field. Theoretically, every single plant mm-hmm. in there is genetically identical. So if a pest or disease is allowed to take off, it tends to spread rapidly in that scenario. So the pests have been kind of brought along with hops to that means to spread that rapidly through the yard. So the predators are at a disadvantage. They've got to pick up the pace and get up there faster than they normally do in the conventional side.
Well, which brings me around to one of the main topics I want to talk with you today about, which is, how do you actually grow hops at home, and how would an average home brewer, interested in growing hops at home get started on that?
Well, obviously you would want to take into account your environment. Where you're growing at. It's difficult in certain environments. Obviously, the person growing in the home garden isn't as concerned about maximizing yield. So the day length issue is less. Whereas we have to make sure we're training just at the right time to make sure we got the right amount of growth when the day length drops and we get flowering. It's not as critical with the home gardener. So the home gardener should choose a plant that is probably less susceptible to disease. So you're going to want a plant that is powdery mildew resistant, or at least very mm-hmm. tolerant. And the same with downy mildew, something that's going to tolerate downy mildew, especially in wetter areas.
So what kind of varieties would you look to maybe grow in an average home?
Well, availability is going to be the issue. Mm-hmm. I would stick with just classic, if I'm going to be growing at home, I would stick with classic varieties that you know are going to, perform relatively well. Some areas, Cascade will do quite well at home, so will Chinook. Other areas, they might have major issues with downy mildew. Nugget can be a good bittering variety for home use. Mm-hmm. Centennial can be a good variety for home use. So anything that's available, if you're going out and contacting online sellers of rhizomes, anything mm-hmm. that's available, could do well. It just depends on where you're at. And I would talk to the person selling the rhizomes based upon.
So describe for me for just a minute what an ideal environment might look like.
Well, to me, an ideal environment is something like the Yakima Valley, where it's nice and dry, but you can add water when needed. To me, that's ideal. And you got the right day length, so you're going to be able to maximize production. Now, with that said, in the home garden, you're going to want plenty of sunlight. Soil mm-hmm. that drains well. I would I prefer soil slightly on the acidic side, the pH slightly below 7. Okay. But hops will grow in a range between 6 and 8. Keep it away from, you know, a lot of people will, hops will naturally, in their natural setting will grow a companion plant. So you might see some sort of shrub or brush growing, and hops will be intertwined with that, or around a fence row, anywhere there's structure for them to grow on. You have to provide that structure as well. In the home.
So what do you recommend for trellises or something like that? What do you need to grow your hop?
If you
obviously they grow vertically in a vine, right?
Right. If you're really looking to maximize the number of cones you can obtain off a given plant, I would allow for up to 20 feet of growth. Our standard trellises here in commercial production are 18 foot tall, and wow. most hop varieties have been selected to grow under those conditions. So, you know, if the home gardener wants to maximize the number of cones they're getting from a couple of plants, oftentimes the side of a house is a good way to grow them. If you could string from the eaves of the house down, or if you have the means to build a trellis, pole and wire work structure, as high as they can get it, works well. Now if it's more a combination of appearance and collecting cones, planting along like a chain link fence tends to work well. I have some experimental trellis that I grow plants for temporary purposes that are only 6-7 feet tall, and the hops grow quite well along those. So obviously we would never be able to maximize production at that rate, at that height, mm-hmm. but for the home gardener, it can work quite well.
So let's say I go out and purchase some rhizomes from somebody, mm-hmm. and I got a trellis and a spot to plant it. What's the next step? What do you, how do you plant them? How deep do they go? How do you water them?
Well, you can be relatively shallow. You don't want to plant the rhizomes too deep. They more than likely would survive. You might, if you plant them too deep, you might end up rotting with time, especially if you're in a really wet environment. So plant them fairly shallow, usually in the early spring.
So a few inches?
A couple inches deep is all from the top of the rhizome. So your rhizome will be, generally you'll get a rhizome about 6 inches long. And a rhizome is just basically an underground stem is what it is. It's not even a true root. You take that rhizome and then you plant that down. So you dig your hole, put that in. So the top of the rhizome is maybe only an inch or two below the soil.
And do you wait until after the last frost, or does it matter?
No, actually with the rhizome, typically, at least in our environment, we like to plant as early as we can. Sometimes, even in February or March, as soon as we can get out in the field, we'll plant a rhizome. Because that rhizome then will sit, and as the soil starts to warm up and the outside temperature gets warmer, it'll begin to grow at a natural rate and grow through the frost.
So it can handle it.
It can usually. A real hard frost will knock them back. Now, with that said, if you have a potted plant, something that you're obtaining as a pot, I would suggest then waiting till after the last frost to plant that. But a rhizome's a little bit different; can be handled differently.
And then care of feeding of the hops. Let's say you get them in the ground. What do you do now?
Typically, you've got them in the ground. You're going to want to keep that soil moist. If you could pick that soil up and ball it up in your hand and it stays together, that's a good moisture level. If you're squeezing it and it crumbles right away, you're probably getting a little dry. But if you squeeze it and it's visible, there's maybe water starting to squeeze out of it, you're too wet. So hops, as we like to say, don't like to get their feet wet. They don't like to be sitting in puddles or undrained water. They like a good drainage and just kind of an as needed watering.
So, I mean, would you recommend using mulch or using, if you're growing at home?
Yeah, absolutely. Mulch works nice for several reasons. I mean, obviously, it conditions the soil over time, and then it also prevents weeds from growing up. Mulch, a nice mulch, especially after the plant gets established, after it's grown up out of the ground, kind of clean up around the base of the plant and kind of mulch around that. Tends to work real nicely. And in dry areas,
gives you a little drainage.
Right. Yeah. And where we're at in dry areas, that mulch will kind of retain water in the soil, moisture in the soil around that root without having to water as much. So
So how often do you have to water it in say a dry area like Yakima?
Well, dry areas, you know, there's different philosophies. Some people will go with an everyday watering in short sets. You know, mm-hmm. they'll run the water, their drip irrigation in short sets almost on a daily basis. We have a tendency to, we'll give a real long watering, you know, say like for 12 or 24 hours and then shut that water down for another 24, 48 hours to kind of let that soil dry out just a little bit. You don't want to get it bone dry, but allowing that soil to dry out a little bit, we think there's a benefit to that. So I would say, you know, even in the home garden, not much different than most of your garden plants. If you give it a good watering, let the soil drain, let it start to dry a little bit, and then add the water again. So maybe every couple of days or something.
So you definitely don't want to keep it too wet.
No, I don't like to see the hot plant sitting in too much water. Certain varieties are, you know, they're susceptible to other soil-borne pathogens. And again, that, you know, it's very difficult to say one way or the other what those might be. It depends on the area, but you get other diseases like Fusarium and Phytophthora that are, you know, prefer a wetter condition in the soil, and you can start to get some root rot and other issues.
Now, you mentioned something about training the vines. What is that process you go through? As the thing's growing up, so it gets longer and longer. What do you do there?
Right. As they grow up, so what you really, to maximize the production of cones on the plant, what you really want to do is control that growth and what you allow to be put onto your growth structure, on your string, as we call it. So, mm-hmm. we're, you know, in the commercial yards, we're putting down core yarn or paper twine. Depending on availability, and we're putting that down, and then we'll train onto those. Now, if you want to maximize the production, what you do is generally cut back the first flush of growth that comes out. You get these real bullish vines that come out of the ground rapidly. Mm-hmm. Generally, what they're relying on is the reserves of carbohydrates that the root had put down the prior season, and they come out of the ground real rapidly. Generally speaking, we'll cut those back. And when you cut those back is dependent upon where you're at, your day length, and several other factors so that you can time it just right. For example, we typically, for most of our varieties, starting in, you know, from the first part of May, the month of May really is what time spent training, depending on the variety, we'll go through and wrap those the growing vines onto the string in a clockwise direction at different times of the month. And we'll go through and do that two or three times to make sure that we get at least two vines per string. And that's,
I see,
typically is what we're targeting. Get two. We'll actually go and tell the people out twine or training to get as many as four, but that's under the assumption we might not get all four of those going up the string. Mm-hmm. We target two to three when it's all said and done, and that gives us the generally speaking, the yield that we like to see. And that's,
you said, so basically you take these things, you wrap them clockwise is what you mentioned?
Yeah.
You
wrap them clockwise around the string.
And how long are they when you're doing that? You said May, but roughly what length are we looking
generally
at?
Generally speaking, you're going to be about a foot and a half, 2 feet. You know, so you're looking at maybe an 18 inch vine that you can wrap onto that. Sometimes shorter, you know, you can go as much as a foot, but you don't want to be necessarily forcing it because they won't necessarily take. You want to be able to wrap it on there and have that stay on the string, and not have to keep going back and rewrapping it.
Okay. So you grow these things all season basically, mm-hmm. right? You keep watering them, make sure they're, I guess that's all you have to really do is water them and make sure they get plenty of sunlight, right?
Yeah. Water and fertility. Fertility is critical.
Right. So are you using fertilizer, or is it something somebody might use at home? Put some potting soil down or something like that? I don't know.
For home use, depending on the intent of the producer, you know, you've got these two different issues. If you're looking to grow organically, mm-hmm. obviously you're going to be a little bit more limited. If you're going conventional, a good, just to, you know, when I talk to gardeners generally, I just suggest a good all-purpose fertilizer. You know, something like a Miracle Grow or something along
Miracle
those
Grow
lines.
Food,
yeah,
plant food or something like that.
Something that's going to have a balanced mix of nutrients. Hops really like nitrogen, so you could supplement maybe with an additional nitrogen application. But typically, a good all-purpose fertilizer that has your macro and micronutrients is going to be a good bet. On the organic
side, do you do that once when you plant, or do you do that again
No, I would definitely supplement through the season. Typically what I do is, I would suggest to people is you look at the growth of the plant. Hops are very rapid growers. During that mm-hmm. period from when we put it on the string in May through June and into the first part of July, everything that's coming up is vegetative growth. And at that time, it's going to grow, you know, under ideal conditions, a hop plant will grow a foot a day. And wow. So it's through the month, you know, through May and in the first part of June, it's relying primarily on its carbohydrate reserves in the root. But after that, it has to convert to what it's getting from the soil. So in that May, June period is a good time to supplement with nitrogen because that's really what it's going to be using up. As the soil, well, I guess I should let's back up a step. As the soil warms up in the spring, that's a good time to be applying like your phosphorus and other nutrients to have that bank there for the plant when it's ready to start using it up. And you have a little bit of nitrogen at that time as well. And then as that plant starts to grow rapidly and you get into that peak of growth and, you know, in that June, July period, supplement at that time with maybe a couple of applications of nitrogen. It can be light applications of nitrogen at that time, but it's going to need something to supplement it, especially after that plant's been in the ground. First year, second year, it might not be a big deal. But as you get further down the road, years in advance, that root is going to be mining that soil and taking a lot out of it. And then when you get into, you know, the flowering period, you know, you can begin applying some other chemicals to supplement that. So, you know, it's almost like any other plant. You just look at that stages of growth and fertilize accordingly. But if you want to keep it simple, an all-purpose fertilizer, maybe two or three times during the summer, it would probably be a good bet.
So, yeah, at some point during the summer, the hop cones actually start to pop up, right?
Yep. As the day length starts to shorten in July, typically is when that happens. Once you get down there below 16 hours of day length, the signal for the plant to flower is there. So that's a, you know, photoperiod response. And typically, around here, you know, we're looking in the latter half of July is when that really kicks in. And so that's
and then. So let's say you're doing this at home. How do you then decide, you know, it's time to harvest?
Well, how do you know? There's going to be about a month period between flowering and when it's probably ready for harvest. You'll notice the initial, you know, flowers popping out and what we call the initial bloom and the initial burr. And those are what develop into the actual cones. So you watch mm-hmm. those develop. You get down to, depending on the variety, you get down towards the end of August, typically. Mm-hmm. And that's when things will start to really develop, and those cones will take on a different feel when they're immature. If you can feel them out in the field, they'll have a real soft feeling. You could squeeze them in your hands and they'll feel real a lot of moisture in them, a lot of water. You can actually squeeze the water out of them.
Juicy.
Yeah. Yep. So there'd be a lot of water in them. And then what needs to happen is that cone will continue to develop in size, and actually as the plant matures through the season, the roots will begin taking, it's the whole source sink relationship in plants, in a perennial plant, that the leaves and everything above ground will then begin supplying the nutrients back to the hop plant or to the roots for the next mm-hmm. season. So the cones themselves are part of that interaction. And so as they begin to develop, they'll begin to lose moisture and gain in size, and the result is an increase in dry matter. And we typically target about 25% for all intents and purposes, 25% dry matter at harvest. So that means 75% of that cone is water, and the rest is dry matter. And that usually indicates a rough indication of maturity. Now, with that said,
so what does that feel like? I mean, if you're
much more papery feel than earlier on. Earlier on, like I said, it has that real soft, watery feel to it. As it mm-hmm. gets mature, one way you could tell is if you could put that cone lengthways in between your index and thumb and squeeze mm-hmm. down, typically the strig, which is the central axis in the cone. If you tear a hop cone apart, it's made up of the bracts and bracteoles, which are the petals, and then a central axis, which is the strig. Well, if you squeeze mm-hmm. lengthways and that strig breaks, that's usually a pretty good indication that you're getting drier. Otherwise, if it's sweat, it'll just fold over with the rest of the cone. And now, with that said, you know, another indicator is, of course, the aroma. The ultimate thing we're looking for, you know, there's a difference between crop maturity and physiological maturity. Physiological maturity would be at the end of harvest, and you know, typically that cone is really just meant as a package to carry that seed and get that the seed, the progeny from that plant, in, you know, distributed. So physiological maturity isn't until the end of September, maybe even into October. But crop maturity is different. What we're really looking for is the lupulin glands, which are tiny little sacs, you know, that are within that cone. Those contain the oils and the acids that we typically associate with aroma and flavor for beer. And so if we're maximizing maturity, you're going to wait until those glands have completely filled and you've maximized the oil content as well as the resin content, the alphas and betas.
So let's say you get to that point and you've decided you want to harvest the cones now. What's the process you go through then?
Well, if we're talking commercial,
maybe describe it on a commercial scale first, and then we'll talk about maybe what some of the home alternatives might be.
Right. So as explaining a commercial operation, what we've done, you know, we started out in the spring tying out down all these strings to our 18-foot trellis, and the plants had grown up those, and they're up and over the wire. So we've got these 18-foot-long vines growing throughout the field. So what we do is we'll go through first, cut the bottoms about 3 feet off the ground. And with what we call bottom cutters, just a tractor with sickle blades on the front. Mm-hmm. That goes through, cuts the bottoms. Truck is then pushed through the field by what we call the top cutter, which is then cutting the vines at the top. And those vines fall into a truck, and they're brought to a stationary hop picking machine, which varies a little bit from farm to farm, but the same general principle is you're taking those vines, stripping all the leaves and cones and everything off of them, And then the machinery is meant to separate just the cones from everything else.
Right.
And so it's a very mechanized process at this point for the commercial hop grower. Without the mechanization, we couldn't do it.
Right.
At one time they were all hand picked, but that's a very, very labor intensive process. In fact, my great-grandfather, when he first started farming hops, he had about 13 acres is all, and he had to employ about 100 people, and it took him 30 days to get the 13 acres. So it gives you an idea. So the mechanization is critical. And so that machine then will separate the cones from everything else and send those into a large commercial drying operation that we just called the kiln. They go into the kiln and they dry for 8 to 12 hours in there, down to about 10% moisture. That's what we target. And those cones are then piled into large piles to equilibrate so that the moisture in the pile and the temperature and everything equilibrates. We mix them up. It mixes them up pretty good so that there's no wet pockets or anything like that. And then they're baled into 200-pound bales. So that's the quick overview of the commercial harvest. Now, for the home gardener, what you're going to want to do is when you determine that you've reached maturity is to simply hand pick the cones. And,
right.
And, you know, typically, you know, like for the breeding program, we used to pick, by hand, prior to getting a small experimental scale, harvester. And, typically we would, it would take about, 2 hours or so to pick a single plant. So it's pretty labor intensive. It takes a while.
So you pick the cones, and obviously you got to dry them somehow.
Right.
You have a good. And how would you go about doing that at home?
That's the big problem for the home hop grower is how do we get these things dried down? Because that's really a critical control point in terms of quality. So the question is, well, what's the best way to do it? And I get asked that quite a bit. And the best way obviously is something like a food dehydrator. If you don't have very many cones, you could take just your typical food dehydrator and mm-hmm. dry them down to 10% moisture, roughly.
Yeah, you can buy one of those relatively cheaply.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Same thing you'd use to dehydrate fruit or something like that, right?
Yep. Now, if you're a little bit larger scale in your home endeavor, you know, if you're real aggressive with it, then you're going to need something else. And I've, you know, there's a number of different things you can build. Just a box that's blowing, you know, warm air through the cones. If you've got the time, you can just blow ambient air through. It'll dry them down. It just takes much longer. The critical thing, I, in my opinion, is you do want the air moving though. You don't want to just set them out to dry. You want to get some air movement through there. And if, especially if you're using the warm air, because that gives you the evaporative cooling effect, or the evaporative effect, rather than just heating them up, you know, and cooking them. So,
well, if I understand it, heat and light is kind of an enemy of hops, right?
It is. It is. You know, and even at the cooler you can dry them, the better. You know, on a commercial scale, we have to be, you know, we have to take into account several factors, that being, for example, the amount of time they're sitting in the kiln. We can't have them in there too long because we'll fill our kilns up and we got to shut down picking, and it doesn't work out real well for us. So there's an efficiency issue we have to deal with. Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, I would say, you know, we typically, like commercially on our Roma hops, we don't dry it at temperatures over 130 degrees. And I would say that's probably, you know, my suggestion would be the max that you'd want to see. You know, otherwise you're getting your oils volatilized and you're losing some right. of that in that process. If you can go lower than that, that's great. And you know, on a commercial scale, when we can, we do dry low at a lower temp, but it's difficult, you know, when you're trying to harvest that much volume.
So you're going to dry them down to, I can't remember the moisture content you're shooting for.
10% moisture. Yep, 10% moisture.
Is similar to what we do with grain, actually, about 10%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And then what do you do with it? After? I mean, what's the hop storage routine, say, for?
Well, from a commercial standpoint, you know, we're taking those hops directly from the bale into cold storage. Cold storage being, you know, 27, 29 degrees, so just below freezing. From a home gardener standpoint, somebody, you know, mm-hmm. and the hops will store for quite a while at that temperature, but they will degrade even at 27 to 29 degrees. So typically what we'll do is we'll pelletize them as quickly as possible, get them into
right
in the foils and, you know, and flushed and vacuum sealed. Obviously the home gardener isn't going to have necessarily that luxury. My suggestion, and we do this with the breeding program where we're doing small scale samples, is to get them dried down. And if you can, vacuum sealed, just something like a food saver or something along those lines works pretty good.
I know you can get barrier bags, yep. you know, if you shop around for them.
Right, yeah. right. You know, something along those
air
lines.
Air barrier bag.
And then if you have room in a freezer, an actual deep freeze, that's great. Hops actually store quite well in the
freezer. Yeah, I store all mine in the freezer. I think most homebrewers do these days.
Yep. And so that would be my suggested route of storage, because you know, typically even after a year, they're still in great shape. So,
well, I thought I'd finish with a couple of questions about your business here. What are some of your favorite hop varieties to use?
Well,
I assume you brew some beer yourself, right?
Yeah. Do a little bit of that. I leave most of that to the experts though. I there's so many beers out there. I like trying them all. So, my favorite varieties, I'm a little bit biased, I got to admit, because, you know, as part of as a hop breeder and being involved in the development of sure. hops like Simcoe and, you know, Tanum and Citra and now Mosaic and Palisade and a few others, I'm a little bit biased towards those, obviously. And for good reason too, though, not just the fact that we were involved in.
What are some of the advantages of those hops, for example?
Well, I think that the flavor you get, if you're obviously like a hop forward beer lover, you know, like an IPA lover or mm-hmm. pale ale, like myself, then the flavors that those hops give, as opposed to some of the more traditional varieties, I just really enjoy that. That's from a you know, beer drinking standpoint. From a growing standpoint, they're also pretty nice to grow. You know, they're good hops. Most of those were selected here in our environment, which versus, you know, you take like your traditional European landrace varieties such as Zatz, Tettnanger, Herzberger, mm-hmm. Hallertau. Those hops were selected
European.
Right. They were selected in a much different environment. So you bring them here in the Yakima Valley and try to grow them, and it can be very difficult, to say the least, to get an economic yield. Whereas these varieties, these newer, you know, these kind of new world hops are more adapted to this environment, and they grow quite well, and we have less of a challenge with them. So
So which hops do you actually sell the most of?
Right now, we sell the most of Simcoe from our farm.
Really?
No. We're one of only six farms in the U.S. that grows Simcoe. One of the original farms that grows Simcoe. So in fact, we had one of the original commercial plantings quite a few years
ago. I don't think it's quite as widely available in the homebrewing market as it is maybe in the commercial.
No, I don't think so, because it's highly sought after. You know, year in, year out, we're increasing the acreage, you know, by 100% plus, trying to keep up with demand.
Homebrewers tend to be at the tail end of the supply chain there, so we take whatever hasn't been used by the big guys, I guess.
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, we can begin to get that changed as we you know, learn to manage these and match up that demand. But the definitely, I think going forward, if you look at the amount of increase in acreage for some of these varieties like Simcoe and Citra, it's so rapid that at some point we are going to reach that point where there's going to be plenty available to all.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any tips for homebrewers?
With regard to, it's kind of a broad question.
Well, I mean, just in terms of using hops or brewing with hops or storing hops, almost anything.
I guess just like anything else, you know, my only suggestion would be to think outside the box, you know, and when you can use these new varieties, try them out, you know, and one of the things that we've done in the past is just found a recipe that we like that, you know, just do a single hop test and see how these different experimentals work. And hopefully I have some thoughts in my head going forward that we can begin to get some of these experimentals out to the homebrew side of things, maybe even before we get them out to the commercial side as kind of a test market, so to speak. And so anytime that, you know, you could see something new available to grab it up and give it a try.
Yeah, I'd certainly support that.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you'd like to add, Jason?
No, I think that's it. That's about it. You know, my suggestion to, I guess the only other suggestion I'd have to both
sure.
homebrewers and anybody else who's brewing beers, use more hops. Use as many as possible.
Use as many as possible.
So,
well, thank you. I really appreciate you being on the show, Jason. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I know you've been very busy, but thank you for taking the time.
Busy is good. So that's a good thing. Thanks for having me.
So again, my guest is Jason Peralt from Peralt Farms, a family-run business in Yakima Valley, established in 1902. Well, I'd like to thank Jason Peralt for doing that great interview. I hope you learned a little bit more about hops. I'd like to remind you again to visit beersmithrecipes.com, our new recipe site, as well as download the new version of Beersmith, Beersmith 2.1 at beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.